Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It is Alejandro T. Rojas, and we have a great show today. We have another in-studio guest, which is always fun because then I'm not as lonely in here. And we just luckily have some great researchers and people out here in Phoenix, so we have enough people to come out here. Today we have Jim DeLotoso, and of course people in the area are definitely going to know that name. And if you've watched UFO documentaries, and I'm sure you're going to know as well because he's in a lot of them, does a lot of photo analysis. Phoenix Lights, of course, was a big deal out here and around the world, and Jim was pretty much the lead photo analyst there. You saw him on almost every Phoenix Lights story, so we'll talk about that. Some people don't know that he looked into the Billy Myers pictures as well, so we'll talk a lot about all of that, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But let us get into the news so we can get to some of that cool stuff. In the news this week, we've had a lot of interesting things. One of them, Russia Today, is a website that covers lots of Russian news. And there's some people who videotaped a large pyramid UFO over Kremlin. So people are still looking into this. The police, interesting enough, in the area didn't have any comments. But Russia Today, you can see a couple stories, and of course, all of these news stories are linked at openminds.tv right there on the front page under our daily UFO headlines, and you'll be able to watch those videos. So very cool, and I know there's a couple more videos that showed up on YouTube today that are kind of the full length of that video, and we'll be getting a hold of those and posting those as soon as possible, probably by the end of the day or in the morning as well. So that was a really cool one. Also, as usual, lots of news in the UK. It's actually slowed down a little bit. They did have, you know, half a dozen stories almost every day about UFOs in the UK for a while there when the MOD was releasing some of their files. It slowed down a little bit, but a gentleman by the name of Richard Hall, who's a researcher out there, his website is richplanet.net. He did a couple cool things this week. First of all, David Cameron, it's the head of the Conservative Party out there. He went to one of his events, and he asked him about UFOs. And luckily, this was all recorded, and he was able to put this on his website. And David Cameron kind of made a joke. You know, everybody's got to have their pat UFO joke, and he's got to say, well, I would think the other party is from a different planet if I didn't know any better. So, you know, the typical politician joke. But then he apologized for joking around and said, you know, I take everything serious, and I'm all for openness and transparency in government, so if I found anything out, I'd let the people know. So kind of another pat answer, but it's just cool. It's always exciting when people are brave enough to ask, because the more this happens, I think it shows that, you know, this really is on people's minds. People are very interested. And what's going on? We talked about last week with Jeff Peckman starting his ballot initiative in Denver and how some of those stories had polls, which showed that people are really in favor of finding out more about UFOs and extraterrestrials. So another thing that Richard Hall did is a documentary called Hidden Truth, and it's on crop circles. And in this documentary, he's pretty much concluding that he thinks that MI5, which is pretty much the British intelligence agency, in fact, MI stands for military intelligence. The MI5 is really who, you know, James Bond would have worked for if he was a real dude. But he has concluded had some involvement with the faking of crop circles. We know there are a lot of people who make crop circles for artistic reasons and for fun, and there's a website out there, Crop Circle Makers, and they're pretty much the main crop circle makers, at least human-wise, the known crop circles that we know are being made by humans. And they have a website, and they're very active, and he kind of talks about their funding, how they're very well-funded, and they have all these anonymous sources for their funding. So some interesting conclusions. He also interviews Colin Andrews on that, who's a famous crop circle researcher out there. And Colin Andrews actually has a story, and kind of in appreciation for this documentary, on his website, he released the name of a CIA agent he's talked about in the past. And this CIA agent approached him and tried to recruit him, essentially, almost said, "You're recruited, you're working for us now." And Colin said, "I don't think so." Like how I always do the British accents for the British people. But
done well.
Thank you. But Colin Andrews named finally for the first time this CIA agent, and he said his name was Sandy Reed, R-E-I-D. So we'll all have to look into this character and find out about his past. So those are some of the interesting stories in the UK. One more that came out was in The Sun. That's the big tabloid, but also a paper that's taken seriously, even though they have like the Page Five girls, which are the bikini girls, and bikinis are optional.
Is that Murdoch or Maxwell's paper?
No, I don't know who has the paper, but it's very big, and it is one of the biggest papers out there, even though it is tabloid, and some of the serious news stories are broken there. But they have amazing UFO pictures of 2009 up there, so you can go check that out. Remember, this is all also on openminds.tv. So, that's the UK. Moving back to the States, there's been some articles about some information some gentleman has sent out there, and one of the stories is called "Why Aren't You Building Your Own UFO Yet?" And that's on IO9's website. You might know IO9, they're kind of a techie underground type of website. So if you're into technical stuff and the latest and greatest gadgets and sci-fi, you'll see that kind of stuff there. But they posted a story about this guy who sent out a press release, and he's trying to get some money from Australia actually also. But he lists, he's got thousands of pages on his website, and you can go look at this stuff for free. And it shows all of the different patents going back to the 50s that introduces or has technology, relates to technology similar to what people are seeing when they describe UFOs. So that's some interesting information. In fact, he's pretty much saying with the information on the website here, you can build your own UFO. And there's several different types. It's not just kind of electromagnetism, but it's several different ways that people are tapping into these. He's not calling it anti-gravity, but ways to limit the gravity that make these devices fly. So some of the patents he talks about were technologies that came from Nikola Tesla, and the Brown Bifield effect you might be familiar with. So you'll have to check this out, especially if you're a tech-type person. It's really interesting. If you do build your own UFO, please get a hold of us here at Open Minds, and we'll give you our address. You can fly on over. We'll make a space for you in our parking lot, and we'd love to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll even pay you to put an Open Minds logo on the side of it. Fly it around downtown. So that's some cool news. This is really weird, too. A few stories on UFOs landing and extraterrestrials coming out of them. And in fact, the UFO Examiner, who writes about MUFON, talked about a couple of MUFON reports that they got from Texas. And both of these reports were of UFOs landing and creatures coming out of these UFOs.
Well, that's our favorite kind.
Creatures?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's much more exciting. I'm really bored with just, you know, the UFOs flying around. You know, people have sightings. That's great. Even, you know, I want to see one up close. I want to have someone fly one over that I can ride and we can put our logo on. Or I want to see one land with some strange creatures that come out so we can say hi. And I don't want the abduction type scenario to happen. You know, I no thanks on the probe or anything, but I'm happy to talk with them. But another one of these cases was posted by the People Magazine Daily, and they talked about a UFO landing in Barstow, California. So maybe we're at the next stage where they're going to start landing and saying hi, and we can invite them over for dinner. Hopefully,
do they eat?
We're not. I don't know. I was reading on some website that they assumed that they ingested blood plasma through their skin. I don't think that's the case. That would be awful. Mm. But I hope they're vegetarians. I know that this guy right here.
Yes.
This little creature we have, that it's an Iargon. I've talked about it before, one of Wendell Stevens cases.
Yes.
And that they said they were vegetarians.
Good for them.
Yeah, I think it's the right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so there's our news for the week, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us for that. Go to openminds.tv, and on the front page, you'll see more about that. I should cover at least a couple of our cool stories we've posted here, too. And that would be from Philip Mantle. He wrote us a story of UK Royal Marines who had a sighting in 1971, and they reported it. In fact, the guy who wrote it talked about his boss essentially having him collect all the photos and reports on it, and they were sent in to the Home Office or wherever the UK military sends that stuff. But, you know, the MOD has been releasing UFO files, and these haven't shown up in those files, so why not? If the UK government is truly releasing everything they know about UFOs, why aren't they releasing this information? In fact, Nick Pope, we did the story last week about how the UK, the MOD said, don't call us anymore if you have a UFO sighting. We don't want to hear it. We're closing down our hotlines. So we got a response from Nick Pope and asked him what he thought, and he said, well, even though officially maybe they're not collecting reports, you know, someone's got to be collecting them. Maybe it's not an official capacity. So that's the newest story we've got out, and if you've been reading the alien autopsy stories that Maurizio has been putting out, then we're going to have number 3 posted by the end of the day. And this one is a couple of coroners in Italy who actually, I think they worked for the Vatican or with them. I mean, they're very well-known coroners, and they watched the video with Maurizio, and they had some comments to make, and so we're posting all of their comments. And this has been a highly controversial, of course, case, an issue. And you, my guest for today, Jim, are no stranger to highly controversial cases, are you?
That's right. I wear my controversial suit whenever possible.
Yep, there you are.
Oh.
So, let's get into it. Thanks for joining us here today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And I wanted to start off with just kind of going back to where you were in life when you started looking into UFOs and why you decided to tackle that.
That was in the 70s, and I was in the business of audio and video.
Mm.
I had a company that rented measurement equipment, signal processing equipment, oscilloscopes, real-time analyzers. And I had that for a couple of years in the mid-70s. And then I started one of the country's leading rock and roll touring companies.
Mm-hmm.
Sound and lights, trucks, touring around doing that, but you don't tour in the winter. And we were doing some pretty well-known bands, Three Dog Night, Moody Blues, and many others. And you don't tour in the winter. You look for other things to do. And with the equipment that we had that included generators and that measurement equipment and lighting equipment, we worked in the film industry. And Arizona became our winter headquarters because it was a winter headquarters for B-movies. So in the winter of 1978, I met Socrates Ballas. He was producing a movie on the Shroud of Turin. And it's the one that's out that's narrated by Richard Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were in pre-production, they were looking for someone who could make some interface equipment so that the scientific iridium equipment could convert those images and scientific measurements to film. We were working on that project that winter, and Socrates Ballas introduced us to another filmmaker named John Stefanelli. John Stefanelli was working with APRO in Tucson to develop a method for analyzing pictures. So John Stefanelli introduced us to Jim Lorenzen and Wendell Stevens to see if, because of our approach in the way that we had worked on his project, that perhaps we would develop a method for APRO on analysis of UFO pictures.
Mm.
And I agreed to do that, since it would take about a year, I said, to find out the processes, the equipment, the manufacturers, the software, the techniques that would be a repeatable method to do that.
And APRO, just so people know, was the Association of, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization.
Yes, and at that time it was a worldwide organization with representatives from most every country in the world, and it was an academic organization.
Yeah. What, NICAP, APRO, and CUCOS, the one started by Hynek, were pretty much the big ones to begin with.
Yes.
Before they all kind of faded out and MUFON became the forefront.
Yes. I traveled with Wendell Stevens occasionally that year to go to big image processing trade shows. And the goal was to find the equipment manufacturers, find out from the manufacturers who owned their equipment that we could go to as service providers in order to determine a repeatable method, create a method. And what are the issues? To analyze pictures of unknown objects. What's their size? How far away from the camera are they? Have they been superimposed? Are they a scale model? And all of the issues that would be related to that. And I published a paper on that, a white paper on that process in 1979 at the annual APRO conference that year. Subsequently, I was asked if we would analyze 40 pictures out of APRO's collection, which included the Billy Meyer pictures.
Mm-hmm. What was the feeling of the APRO people back then about the Billy Meyer photos?
They had no position on it. It was, no position that I could interpret.
Okay.
My sense of it was that they had included some known models in the batch of 40 in order to determine the success of the testing process. And at that time, the process was a sequence of different labs to go to. There wasn't a place other than Ground Saucer Watch that tested UFO pictures. And in fact, Ground Saucer Watch went to a particular manufacturer and did it there. We went to that facility also.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal was to develop a repeatable process and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
But for the 2 years that I was supervising that process, the labs all signed, and we had them sign non-disclosure agreements,
mm-hmm.
which means we won't talk about the fact that we're coming here, and you won't talk about the fact that you even know us.
So how did you feel about getting involved with all of this at this point?
Well, I had two hats that I wore. One was the rock and roll business, mm-hmm. and which is a business. It's a lot of fun, but it is a business. And the other was my scientific measurement business, mm-hmm. which was a precise and confidential business.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination of the two, I felt like the Blues Brothers on a mission from God, you know, to do some private analysis. So it was.
So you weren't opposed to it.
I wasn't opposed to it, but it was pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
There was no one to pay me to do it, nor did I ever ask for anyone to pay me to do it. And some of the cases were very costly once I got involved with it, with money out of pocket,
right?
Which a lot of people wouldn't know, you know, how much it really cost to send a few people running around doing things, but it would be tens of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
Fortunately, I had cash flow from the music business in order to do that, yes.
It's interesting, too, because Maurizio was a rock and roll writer to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Talbot, who I had on, is very scientific-minded now, used to work as a rock and roll producer. So lots of, from rock and roll to UFOs.
And back.
Yeah.
Right. And the business continued successfully for many years, and we added other divisions. We added a computer graphics and animation service bureau in the late 80s, and we set up shop inside of Arizona State University at the Computer Institute, which I was one of the founders of.
Mm.
So out there in the real world, our work was very well known. It was given high levels of scientific credibility. Meanwhile, over in the UFO community, we were the target for hand grenades. So I was always reticent to go over into the UFO community and spend a lot of time there explaining what we were doing, because very few people ever wanted to see the scientific reports or the analysis or the techniques of the way we did it, which was based on forensic methods.
I guess it's kind of like when you're driving your car. Like for me, I'm not a mechanical type of person. I don't want to know what's going on under the hood.
Yes.
As long as it's working. So probably a lot of people are like that. I know in this field, a lot of people are like, tell me if it's real or not. I don't know the technical details about what you're doing with that photo. I just want to know if it's real or not.
Yes, but in reality, you have to spend a lot of time analyzing it, because there's a lot of armchair skeptics who are going to say,
yeah,
what about this, what about that? And
mm-hmm.
it can take many, many hours to analyze one photograph, particularly in the 70s and 80s when equipment was limited.
Mm-hmm.
A scanner was $80,000.
Wow.
Then the resolution, the software, the techniques of doing it were costly.
Mm-hmm.
But the issues, the fundamental issues then and now are still the same.
Mm-hmm.
How big is it? How far away is it? You know, is it a dust particle? Is it a flare? Is it a cloud? Is it an airplane light?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the characteristics to do that? So we built an extensive database of known objects. And when we have unknowns, we extract the data from the unknown, compare it to the database of knowns, try to get a match. Like fingerprints. You have a database of millions of fingerprints that are known.
Right.
You get a fingerprint that's unknown. You extract the data as best you can for the fingerprint that's left, and try to get a match. If you don't get a match, well, it's an unknown guy. If you don't get a match in analyzing the photographs, it's an unknown.
Right.
Unknown. Unknown doesn't mean it's an alien spacecraft. It means that we don't have a match in the database.
So with the unknowns, how often were you finding lots of knowns with the APRO material?
Well, you know, I don't know how to classify that as a lot of knowns. I mean, I would get knowns, I would get unknowns, I would get
I guess what
data.
Was the ratio that you were finding with those?
In the APRO 40?
Mm-hmm.
I would say there was 20 that were unknown, 10 that were, or so, that were airplanes or...
Mm.
Light reflections. That was a key thing to determine the software to determine if an object is light emitting or light reflecting.
Right.
It's round. Okay. Is it a disc or is it an orb? Does it have curvature to it, or is, you know, I'm saying, is it a coin or is it a ball? Is it a disc or is it an orb? And I mean, many, many, many issues. And I went to lots of experts, lots and lots of experts, including Michael Malan,
mm-hmm.
who years later is known as Richard Hoagland's nemesis.
Right. Yes, yes.
But at the time, Michael Malan was working at Jet Propulsion Laboratory and working at Arizona State University and was quite open-minded about mm-hmm. testing the Billy Meyer photographs.
Interesting.
And he found no evidence of a hoax.
Yeah.
Couldn't find any evidence that it was a small model. And that's really what we were looking mm-hmm. for then. Is this a small model? And what are the characteristics? And since we were looking at film, one of the things was if it was superimposed, that we would look for multiple grain patterns. And the multiple mm-hmm. grain patterns show up in the image area, but would be different in the sprocket areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where the sprocket holes are in the film.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you're superimposing images, you'll get two grain patterns in the square image
gotcha.
Area in the middle, but out in the sprocket area, which we were also analyzing, we would have other grain to look at.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Billy Meyer pictures that we looked at, second and third generation film is useful because we then have more grain patterns to look at to be able to see if there's more grain patterns in the image area than there is in the sprocket area.
Hmm.
And never found that in the Billy Meyer case. And as the years went on, a lot of hearsay about so-and-so tested it and found it to be a hoax. No white papers ever written,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of emotional power behind the skeptics saying, well, we proved it to be a hoax. Well, where? How? I mean, what? Show me the testing.
Well, and that's how I feel about Billy Meyer. Everybody, it's such a heated, controversial debate.
Yes.
And I agree with you that... a lot of people will say, that's easy to do. I can do
right.
it. But nobody without Photoshop has demonstrated that they can do it or written up how they have discovered these things to be hoaxes, just like you're saying. I mean, if someone was able to write something up, do an analysis, show us with the technology
yes.
they had back at the time how it could be done, that would be something different. But to my knowledge, and everywhere I've looked, even talking to the skeptics, nobody's done that. The biggest,
yes.
there was someone just like last year who was reproducing some Billy Meyer photos, but he was using Photoshop.
Yes.
And he was saying, look, they're all fakes. I can do this with Photoshop.
Yeah, well, Photoshop didn't exist in the 70s
yeah.
until I took those pictures. I'm not an advocate or a promoter of the Billy Meyer case.
Mm-hmm.
I do analysis.
Right.
And I stand by my work of not being able to find evidence of a hoax or get a match. Doesn't mean that I'm authenticating the fact that it's an alien spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
But out there in the rest of the world, the techniques that I use, I've been an expert witness in murder cases in court, analyzing video. Nighttime case where there's an unclear person committing a crime, and who is that person? So in a court of law, I can testify in a murder case where someone's life is at stake also, and I'm considered an expert witness in that. But over in the UFO arena,
mm-hmm.
Target for hand grenades, and that just goes along with it. I mean, that's part of it. It used to bother me a lot. It doesn't bother me anymore.
Yeah.
It bothers me when my daughter, who's 10, looks up daddy on the internet and finds... Daddy, are you really a con man? No, Savannah. People can write anything they want. But the real important thing about any case is to study the evidence available and prepare it as though it's going to be admissible in a case, in a court case,
right.
as evidence. And to that degree, I decided many, many years ago to follow forensic standards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many issues. You know, people flip-flop all the time. But, well, you can't test anything but the original or the second generation, or it has to be film. Hey, you do the best that you can with what you have,
right,
and what's made available, and you can test second generation. You can test third generation.
Now, have you had the opportunity to test the originals on the Meyer case?
Four pieces of film.
Mm-hmm.
That were the piece of film that were in his camera.
Okay.
And this is
the motion film or the stills?
No, this is stills.
Okay.
This is stills. And found no evidence of a hoax, found no sequence processes by which he could do it with the technologies available. And our team, Tom Welch and Lee Elders, went to the local post office, went to the local drugstore, went to the places where Billy goes to take his film and get it processed. And how does he do it? Well, he comes in with his camera and opens it up on my desk and gets an envelope and puts it in it and hands it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I process the film and bring it back and hand it to him. There's the pictures.
Yeah.
So he's not operating an optical lab. And we went to see Wally Gentleman, who is one of the better known model makers in Hollywood, worked at Linwood Dunn's world famous film effects of Hollywood company. They did films such as 2001. And Linwood Dunn had done the original King Kong. And they at that point had accumulated a lot of history and a lot of expertise in optical effects. And we had Wally Gentleman analyze how he thought, what would it take in order to recreate that.
And 2001 was groundbreaking for its time. It's amazing to look at that movie and look at Star Trek, the original series, and see this huge gap between the quality and the, and the special effects.
And unbeknownst to me, Wendell Stevens, Lee Elders, and Tom Welch had Wally Gentleman make a scale model. Took it to Switzerland, hung it on a fish line at a 20-inch diameter scale model, and Billy Meyer and all of them took photographs of it and then brought the photographs back to me in Arizona to analyze. And I could tell within minutes in my analysis technique, this is about 1981.
What are some of the telltale signs that you're able to identify?
When it's a small object? It's kind of what a painter does. An oil painter is going to paint a portrait. And the painter has decided to have in the picture the moon, and in the painting it's 4 inches in diameter, and a basketball right beside it. And it's going to be painted photorealistically so that it really does look like you're standing looking at the moon.
Right.
But on the painting, it's 4 inches in diameter. And a basketball that's bouncing and coming towards you, and it's 4 inches in diameter. But your eye needs to be able to say, this is a basketball that's 10 inches in diameter coming at me, and this is the moon a great distance. How does the painter do that? If you think about a paint-by-number kit, where it looks like a coloring book,
right,
and it's line drawings, the moon, a large object, will have more lines of longitude and latitude. In that 4-inch diameter object, we might have 50 lines vertical and 50 lines horizontal that we would then use our paint-by-number kit and paint it to give it that contour. The basketball, we might have 10 lines of longitude and latitude. So its contour, the number of shades that it takes to make it be apparent, is going to be reduced.
Okay.
Second, a large object with a light shining on it, the painter is going to have a small area be reflecting the light, the number of sections.
Gotcha.
On a small object, the sun, for example, is going to light up the entire basketball or a small object. if we have a dome, a space dome, like the Seattle Dome, you know, the sun on that is just going to be a little glint on top of it. Now, that's the extremes of proportion. But if something is reflecting light, the ratio of the reflecting area that's bright to the entire surface is going to be, there's more light on a small object than there is in a large object. So we've got the number of lines of contour, we've got the total surface area that is reflecting light, and the properties of the edges.
Hmm.
Everything in real life is in focus. But as soon as our eyes or a camera lens looks at it, the properties of the edges change because of depth of field,
gotcha,
of the lens,
mm-hmm,
the distance it is, closer and further away. So I developed a technique called focus field indexing. Similar to the way that cell animation at Disney with painted glass.
Right.
That here's the mountains, here's the hills, here's the trees, here's the shrubs, you know, all coming forward. And the properties of the edges are different,
mm-hmm,
on all of those. Right. So we've taken a picture and we analyze the edges of hundreds of edges in the picture. Some of them we may be able to go and measure that tree. How wide is the trunk of that tree? How far away was it?
Mm-hmm.
Or this is an unknown distance, but we do know that this is a Washington rose. So we can put in known properties to objects that we can identify and then take all the objects that have similar edges, and they're going to be in the same plane, the same index, the same distance away. Although this one's way over on the right-hand side, and its edge index might be, let's say, 4 pixels wide.
Mm-hmm.
Way over on the left-hand side is a fence post, and it's 4. So that tree and that fence post, even though they're in totally different areas of the picture, would be indexed to be the same distance away.
Gotcha.
Focus field indexing to be able to determine the distance away that an object is by the properties of the edges.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to the way that the optics in a cruise missile can look and say, oh, that's the moon. It's okay. Keep going that way. Oops, there's a basketball coming towards us. Let's move a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And those three principles, the number of shades of color in a contour, if you look at this coffee cup,
mm-hmm,
it's all really black.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the lighting, it looks like different shades of black, different shades of gray or green or blue or whatever. So in a paint-by-number kit, it's coffee boiling. If we're going to do a paint-by-number kit, and we wanted to show that it was contoured,
right,
whether it was a big object or a little object, it would be
black,
this shade of green, this, then the next shade of green, the next, okay? So that's one of the ways to be able to gather data,
mm-hmm,
about whether an object is large or small.
Mm-hmm.
It's the properties of the edges, the distribution of reflected light on the object, and the number of intersecting longitude and latitude lines in the object.
Makes sense. I was smirking because it's all blank on my coffee cup except for the cool Open Minds TV logo.
Yes, that beautiful Open Minds blue logo.
Yeah, you can go get these coffee cups on the website.
You can? People can act. You have something for sale?
Yeah.
You sell hats and shirts and things too?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
T-shirts.
Great.
No hats yet. And none of the cool shirt like I got on today.
Do you like my Melissa Etheridge hat?
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, with her official...
It's funny, though. It's interesting, all the rock connections, which is cool.
Yes.
See, that means it's cool, dudes. Stan Friedman was able to show that smart people get involved with UFOs. All you guys who came from the rock industry show the cool people. So it's the cool and the smart people.
Yes. In the rock industry, though, we were known as very high-tech,
mm-hmm,
people. We were not an also-ran in the industry. We were one of the better-knowns and respected touring companies.
Cool.
Did really complex shows.
Well, on the Billy Meier case,
yes.
It's interesting that Malin was interested in this stuff. He's a guy, for people who don't know, who runs the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And some people don't know that a lot of these satellites that go up, it's not NASA who owns the picture. It's a JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. And that's why Richard Hoagland fights with him, because Richard Hoagland essentially got him to say, hey, you're going to get whatever pictures I give you in whatever shape I decide to give them to you, so deal with them,
yes.
You know, because Hoagland accused them of hiding pictures.
Very few people know that Michael Malin worked on the Billy Meier case.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
The only place it's published is in the book Light Years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a section in there that talks about Michael Malin analyzing pictures. The author of the book went and interviewed Michael Malin. Did you really do it? And did you find any evidence of a hoax? And how and why did you do it?
What did he say?
Well, he said he found no evidence of a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say there was an extraterrestrial spacecraft. He said he found no evidence of it being made by Billy Meier or humans.
I saw him do a talk in Denver about 5 or 6 years ago, because we have a Mars research thing at our museum in Denver. And he was saying some pretty groundbreaking things for that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was before NASA wanted to really admit that there was evidence of an atmosphere on Mars.
Yes.
And he was saying, oh, yeah, there had to be tropical, there had to be oceans, because all of the sand and everything, it had to have been eroded down from vast amounts of waters, which was pretty interesting. But, of course, he has those arguments with Malin. Were there other people involved with the Billy Meier case that I know back then, you know,
well, of
like,
course, yeah,
that were shocking that people don't know about, you know, higher level?
Well, most people know, of course, Wendell Stevens,
yeah,
and Lee and Britt Elders,
mm-hmm.
and Tom Welch. Lee and Britt owned Intercept Company, which was a highly regarded private countermeasure company, and Tom Welch, whose father, James Welch, was a high-level FBI.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he was very intrigued by the case?
Well, he was involved with it on a daily basis for four or 5 years, Tom
really?
Welch was. And we went to a lot of places to have the Billy Meier case analyzed.
Mm-hmm.
Marcel Vogel at IBM.
Right.
We went to SAIC Company. We went to the Anti-Submarine Warfare Center.
Wow.
We went to TRW. We went to Sandia Laboratories. We went to...
And these were all places that aided in the investigation.
There were two ways it was done. One, it was people that had an interest in the topic.
Okay.
And were able to... Moonlight. We're able to use under appropriate conditions the equipment at their facility to analyze the pictures or the metal samples.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, the metal samples. Now, regardless of all the hoo-ha about the Billy Meier photographs, analyzing the metal samples, which was done by Marcel Vogel, and I think a number of times he had J.J. Hertak, with him when the analysis was being done. That is much more compelling to me, the analysis that was done by Marcel Vogel of the metal samples.
Well, let's get into that. What were the metal samples? How were they allegedly retrieved?
Yeah.
And what was found?
They were allegedly handed to Billy Meier by one of the extraterrestrials in a box one night. And Billy gave them to the group, Lee, Tom, Britt, Wendell, the following day, and they were coming back to the United States. They got back to the United States, and one of the first things that we did, they brought them to me, and I laid them out on a on the floor. I had a studio at the time up at Scottsdale Air Park, and we took all the samples and laid them out. They were rocks. They were black sand looking. They were silver solder looking. None of it looked exotic. There were four stages of their materials. There was an explanation from them to Billy, to the group, to me, on how they were made, what they did. How were these four stages all about? We'll get to that in a minute. We laid them all out, we inventoried them, and then we set out to decide, well, how are we going to have them tested? Well, we need to put in some controls of things that we know what they are. Hey, this looks like silver solder. Let's put in some real silver solder. This looks like black sand. Let's put in some other black sand. And we created a little kit. First kit went to Dr. Walter Weir, material scientist at University of Arizona. He did his series of tests. In fact, one package was sent to Omni Magazine. This is when we were young and foolish. And, one package was sent there. One package went to MIT. And one package, after careful study, I determined that this guy, Marcel Vogel, who was a scientist at IBM and was one of the founding members of the Mandala Society and the Noetic Sciences Foundation, would be a good person to go to. So we went to him, and he used his advanced microscope lab to analyze the different materials. Now, because we had put controls in, sample 1B and, you know, 9C, whatever, we knew what the numbers referred to.
Right.
So we expected that this sample would be silver solder, and this sample would be, you know, a piece of granite. But two of the samples in particular were bizarre to Marcel Vogel and to all of us, because in his destructive and non-destructive testing, he found that in this one particular sample that it showed traces of atomic elements 1 through 59, half of the periodic chart, all in one substance. All in one substance. Now, that includes noble gases that don't combine with anything. And to find all of those elements in one substance was completely startling to Marcel. The second thing, when he polished it and looked at it under a scanning electron microscope, found that there were organic materials, unburned, nestled right up against materials that were melted, like thulium and platinum that melt at 2,600 degrees, with little pieces of fern. Organic materials, biofringent materials, interlaced with high-temperature metals.
And what did this material look like to the eye? Was it, well, it looked like a rock? Or
it looked like a glump of solder, of melted silver solder.
Okay.
A glump. And it was sliced and then polished.
Gotcha.
And he couldn't explain it. He couldn't explain how it could be made. He couldn't make it. And he was one of the key members of the team at IBM that had developed some things like color television phosphors, magnetic floppy disk emulsion, advanced materials for for the time. And he gave us a two-hour videotape report, which we still have, of course, looking at with the images through the microscope and what he was saying. Look, I can't imagine how this would be made or where it would come from or how it would be done. And with all the controversy that was going on in the pictures, and a lot of mean-spirited people, what they had to say about the Meyer case, it was decided that the UFO community was not the place to platform the findings on a daily or regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
There would be some books published, and it would be released to the UFO community and the mass population at the same time. That was it. There was no obligation to the UFO community to show anything mm-hmm. to them, because there was not a sense of science, peer review, dignity. There wasn't. And I'm sorry to say, to this day, pretty much still isn't, and it's even worse.
Well, and I know what you mean, and really, I think whenever I think towards this field, it's important to think bigger than and outside of just the small UFO community, because really that's not who we're talking to anyway. We want to convince and show the conventional academics out there that there's some credible stuff and that it's worth spending their time looking at some of this.
Yes.
So I would understand why you would want to do that, and I think that's a better avenue.
Mm-hmm. And there's also one other thing to consider, and that is if extraterrestrials come here and they can communicate with us, that if extraterrestrials didn't want there to be a cover-up, there wouldn't be one.
Mm. Gotcha.
That they allow it to happen. In fact, they may encourage it to happen. And then it becomes an analysis of why do they think like that? Is it something sinister? Are they going to, you know, cook us and eat us later? Or do they have some purpose in their remaining separate, because maybe they want to see how we're going to go with our own free will and our own destiny? Because in the meantime, they behave like a covert operation.
Mm-hmm.
They're here, they're gone. They're there, they're not.
Right.
Pass through walls, kidnap people,
mm-hmm.
abduction, kidnapping. It's
yeah.
against, you can't do that. That's illegal. You go to jail for life if you kidnap people. Mm-hmm. And extraterrestrials seem to do it at will. Now, is it for some positive reason that we don't really understand? Is there something that we have that they're really interested in? So the analysis of the pictures and the UFO cases, of the hundreds and hundreds of cases that I've analyzed pictures, it became more important for me to do it, for me to understand what was going on, not for me to be a conduit every time I had something to turn around and shout it out there to the world or to the media, because there was not very much positive that was going to come of it.
Mm-hmm.
People would say mean things, lies, create problems, which I had to deal with a lot over the years.
Well, especially people like Billy Meyer, especially the experiencers or the abductees, that they often, such as Travis Walton or even some of Robbie Williams was saying this week, who's the star who came out to say he believes in UFOs, they start to say, I wish I never would have opened my mouth and even gone there, because
mm-hmm.
people just get too crazy about it or mean. Do you have that feeling at all?
Oh, yes, of course.
Really?
Well, I mean, there have been things said about me by a particular group going back many, many years that there's no foundation in fact at all. But because of their vocal approach, Cal Korf,
mm-hmm.
one in particular that said and wrote things about me and other UFO investigators,
yeah.
had no basis in fact or truth at all whatsoever, became viewed as fact.
Mm-hmm.
by the UFO community and the general public. And even though Cal Korf has been summarily discredited now, no one has gone back and undone the damage that he did.
Right.
And people, most of what people believe about the Billy Meyer case is based on things that Cal Korf claims he discovered or he did or he said, which people now have found out that it was all lies.
Yeah.
He didn't have any scientific ability at all. He didn't have any team. He wasn't working at all these places doing these things. But people say that the Billy Meyer case is not true, generally because of what Cal Korf said,
mm-hmm.
and that the messengers of the Billy Meyer case of the last few years have been UFO merchants.
All right.
I mean, they're selling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
CDs, public lectures, whatever, for the purpose of making a living, and that's it. I mean, and it's okay to make a living in things in the paranormal if you're making a living distributing the truth,
mm-hmm.
the facts, but distributing information just based on whatever somebody says or thinks that moment and packaging it up and rolling it out there so that you can, like a carnival huckster, collect the money has added insult to injury on the Billy Meyer case and other quality cases where people throw out the baby with the bathwater. And that's it.
Well, it's easier to be a debunker or a skeptic, it would seem, because there are a lot of people who... It's too difficult to think of the implications of what some of these findings are.
Yes.
It's easier just to be able to bury your head in the sand. And the media loves to jump on that. A lot of people still believe that crop circles are all made by these two old guys that after they're drinking at the pub, they're going mm-hmm. out and making all these huge crop circles overnight
yes.
and all over the world. Or, you know, there's a number of other stories like that. But that's the easy way out, it would seem.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, a lot of people take the easy road.
Yeah. Who else can we pick on?
Well, we don't know. One of the questions, I think one of the areas maybe we should move into with
okay.
the remaining time, is into the Phoenix Lights, because, of course,
yes.
That was a big deal, and really, which was great. You know, the media had you all over the place to talk about the lights and your analysis on the lights. So where were you when this happened, and how did you find out about all of it?
Well, it happened in Phoenix, and I live in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And the night of the Phoenix lights...
Did you see them?
No, did okay. not. I was hosting Stephen Greer editing in my facility. I was donating time. And I had a policy pretty much of if someone asked me in the right way, I would let them use the facility for editing or analysis without charge.
And those he was editing mm-hmm. at the time, those great disclosure witness testimony DVDs that are out now, right? Or
yeah, that's what he was editing.
Yeah.
That's what he said he was editing.
Oh, okay.
You know.
It wasn't naughty stuff, was it?
No, it wasn't that. It was just... I don't want to get into it right now, but frequently I found what Stephen Greer said he was doing to be at variance with what he was really doing. And anyhow, we were in the facility editing, and of course the phones all went to the switchboard that night. I didn't find out about the Phoenix Lights event until the following morning when some... local news stations contacted me. Channel 10 and Channel 3 in Phoenix for the years before the Phoenix Lights, because I'm here in town, they would frequently have me on local TV, you know, analyzing
mm-hmm.
different things that happened. So I took a look at them, you know, the following day, and then it just began to accumulate the number of press people that were coming and the number of witness reports and how we were going to get at what was happening was to create some, quote, town hall meetings
mm.
where we had at least half a dozen of them with 100 or more witnesses all at the same time.
That's what's amazing. That I think even people to this day, at least throughout the rest of the country, don't realize how many witnesses there were. There were probably thousands.
Probably thousands.
I know Barwood, the councilwoman, she said she talked to over 1,000 people
yes.
herself.
Yes. And there was no video evidence up until the 10 o'clock event, which was what we were trying to find. We were having a town hall meeting so we could find someone, anyone, that had taken pictures or shot video before the 10 o'clock event.
Mm-hmm.
But the first sightings, you know, started about 7:30, and the lights moved over the entire state,
mm-hmm.
Diagonally from the Sedona area through Phoenix down to Tucson, turned around, came back, and then left the state about 10:30.
I don't think cell phones, were there even many cell phones then?
Well, yeah, there were cell phones.
But I guess not that took pictures.
Yeah, certainly not that took pictures.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny to think about how quickly the technology has changed mm-hmm. and advanced.
Mm-hmm.
How did the video come about then? I think they had it early on, at least some video, right?
Oh, they did. You know, the television stations had three different sets of video the following day
mm-hmm.
and brought them down. And then the day after that, a woman that wanted to remain anonymous because of her job, Dr. Lynn Keetai, for years we referred to her as Dr. X.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure. She didn't want to be on the news. She wanted anyone to know. She had video and film, 35-millimeter film.
Mm-hmm.
So we were analyzing a 35-millimeter film, but we couldn't tell anyone we had it.
Interesting. And then she also, though, what's great about her, she had taken some video a month prior
mm-hmm.
of a similar
yes.
type of thing.
Yes. And I put three or four of my staff people on it of a few hours a day. We put a lot of time and attention into it. Well, we were running a service bureau at the time. Village Labs was a service bureau doing image processing software for pretty large companies.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we were working on some novel software that at the time a number of reporters said did not exist, that is now standard
wow.
at the FBI and Department of Justice and other forensic analysis, and it's spectrum analysis software.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, the reporters who were talking to us about it went and talked to a couple of astronomers who said, there's no such thing as spectrum analysis of videotape. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a hoax. It's a fraud. And when 3 years later, that software became published by IEEE and SIGGRAPH, and is now even on the FBI, Department of Justice, website as the standard in image analysis. No one in the UFO community that called me a lying sack of shit. Oh, I mean, oh no, I've ruined the show. It was much even stronger than that back then. No one comes forward and says, oh, we're so sorry that we dismissed everything that you were doing. Oh, yes, now we see that it's a standard
mm-hmm.
by the FBI and others. You just have to let it go.
This software that was able to look at the different types of lights and determine kind of what they were, the source?
Well, it looks at different lights. It's pretty basic. I mean, for anyone that even uses Photoshop or any image painting program, let alone an image analysis program, you know that light is broken up into red, green, and blue. Any pixel on the screen is defined by its red, green, and blue content,
mm-hmm.
RGB, on a scale usually from 0 to 256. You have each red, green, and blue. So if you analyze a light, you get its red, green, and blue content, its RGB value, as a histogram, as a color spectrum. You analyze the color spectrum in lights and can compare this white light to that white light to that white light and see if they are all matching, identical, and also see if they're stable or flickering or moving or a number of different properties.
Gotcha.
It's all pretty much standard as the only really way that you can do it.
Is it precise enough to tell, like, an airplane from a helicopter?
Provided you have that airplane light already stored, and provided you have the helicopter light, something to compare to.
Gotcha.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, every time. You can say, this light is exactly like this one, but it's not like this one, or this one.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So in the Phoenix lights, and in some of what you looked at, you found that the lights weren't similar to any nodes.
They were not flares because they were not modulating. They were not flares flicker
mm-hmm.
like a candlelight. If you look at it as a graph, think of it as music,
mm-hmm.
sound. And you're looking at an oscilloscope, and when it's quiet, the graph is way at the bottom. You have a mic, take a drum, blam, you hit the drum, and the graph will immediately go up, and then it will immediately go down.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a violin, you hit the note, it'll come on in a different way. Whereas a drum coming on and going off looks like a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a violin looks kind of like a little hill going up and then going down.
Gotcha.
So you look at the way it comes on, the way it goes off, and the way it sustains.
Mm-hmm.
So a graph of a light in this room, you flip the light switch, it's dark, and the light comes on a certain way. And then the light stays on.
And it's constant.
It's constant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the Phoenix lights, unknowns, were constant. And the flares, no two flares are identical. Maybe very close,
mm-hmm.
but they're not identical.
Now, the images that you see out there of the Phoenix lights, the most popular ones,
yes.
Who took that video?
Mike Christen.
Okay, and in the Mike Christen video, some people say that those were flares, but those weren't what most people had said. Were you able to find in the research, were there any flares that were dropped that night to your knowledge?
Well, we didn't find any video of flares.
Mm-hmm.
There was an issue about whether those lights were in front of the Estrella Mountains are behind the mountains
right.
and above it or below it, and we have conflicting analysis in that.
Mm-hmm. I saw you do some analysis on that.
Right. And remember, in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
video frame capture boards didn't exist.
Mm.
There's one frame at a time. You can grab one frame at a time of video. Well, they did exist, but they did not exist in our analysis equipment. And those kind of graphic cards at the time were $30,000.
Wow.
Where now a graphics card is $30, okay.
Yeah.
And the software, and this, and that, were all different.
Mm-hmm.
So as the years went on and equipment became more available, different levels, and we analyzed it again, we would get more information, not necessarily different information, but get more information that would lead us to be able to make a conclusion about something that we were uncertain of before. So the way the lights came on and the way the lights stayed, not modulating, the unknown lights, and the way that they went off, were not characteristic of flares at all. The brightness, there were flares from that distance. The characteristics of those flares, and we went to the manufacturer, we went to flares experts, found out what flares did, how bright they needed to be in order to be this bright on a video camera at 70 miles away, and the curvature of the Earth. How high would they have to be in order to be seen 70 miles away
mm-hmm.
With this brightness and these characteristics. And we just couldn't find anything that indicated that they were flares
mm-hmm.
optically. Second, the public information officer at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson said, yes, we had planes up. They did drop flares at the Barry Goldwater Range, and they were on the ground at 8:30. That conversation happened between Bill Hamilton and the public information officer at Davis-Monthan. Some months later, the public information officer for the Arizona National Guard, Captain Eileen Benz, said that the Maryland National Guard was here and had dropped flares at 10 o'clock, which was what was seen by everyone, and that that's what accounted for. Well, that's a lot of time, months and months, mm-hmm. for no one to know that the Maryland National Guard had been here and dropped flares. And the times didn't match.
Well, and then McGaha on Larry King, I think he's an astronomer, right? He was saying that he believed for some reason they were A-10s.
Yes.
And which are extremely loud tank killers. What are they? Aren't they even called warthogs?
Warthogs, yes.
So, and I don't know where he got that from, especially when what was reported had no sound.
Yes.
Even in the video.
Yes. Well, there was a lot of hearsay, and there was a lot of rush to judgment about it. All I know is, in my analysis, I found no indication that it could be flares. I found no witnesses to the fact of it being flares. But even some of the witnesses of the 8 o'clock event or earlier have talked about it being flares. So there's not a consensus of anyone that, quote, believes in the Phoenix Lights, thinks that there were not flares, and people that don't believe in the Phoenix Lights or whatever say that it is flares. It's a mission accomplished mm-hmm. by someone to create a confusion.
A couple of questions on the chat yes. regarding the Phoenix Lights. Was there ever any video or pictures that were taken where you were able to make out any sort of structure?
No. No video where I could make out a structure.
Mm-hmm. Of course, witnesses had said a chevron type of thing.
Yes.
And were the lights always in a configuration that supported that?
We did a model mm-hmm. of a configuration of the lights in a computer-based model based on various witness reports and on the videos that we had, and then rotated it in different positions mm-hmm. to be able to get that view from that angle at that position of what would look like a different object
mm-hmm.
And found consistency that it could have been just one object with lights on it, but when viewed from different angles, would look like a different configuration of lights. And there were a number of witnesses that reported the lights, quote, undocking from mm-hmm. the object flying off at a great distance.
Really? Wow.
And then others that reported seeing the lights docking back on that object.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So another question is, have spectrometers ever been used to analyze light, and would that be effective?
Well, you know, like not a mass spectrometer, because you can't do that with video. That's a different chemical process. And there's devices that are spectrometers that are used in film, mm-hmm. in analyzing film. This has been in video. We get a version of that. Doing color spectrum analysis, and that's one of the things that we use to give the lights an index number so that we can try to match it to the database. And yes, we have used software to do a color spectrum analysis, not a chemical spectrum analysis. You can't do that on videotape.
Mm-hmm.
Like astronomers do with stars. That was the basis for a lot of confusion back then.
Mm-hmm.
That our use of that word and astronomers' use of that word is
different,
yes.
Gotcha. Anna, I was curious how you felt then when during this period of time, Fife Symington had had his press conference.
Yes.
And came out with his guy, his aide, wearing the ET outfit.
I felt immediately that someone had gotten to him and said, the investigation that you said you're going to do, you're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to make fun of it.
Do you still believe that's the case?
Well, he said in interviews in the last couple of years, including one with James Fox, that no one ever came and
His answer
said that to him.
Makes sense that he was trying to defuse the situation because people were really excited about
yes.
it. And he was at a loss as what to do.
Yes.
Because he wasn't able to do anything.
I haven't talked to him
mm-hmm.
about it. I can't look him in the eye and know what he's revealing now. That's the rest of the story. But remember, the National Guard was under his control.
Mm-hmm.
Eileen Benz that came forward and said it was the Maryland National Guard would have been in regular dialogue with him at that same time.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the feds were coming after him. Because they didn't like what he was doing in states' rights.
Hmm.
The big thing that Fife Symington did was when the federal government ran out of money one weekend and closed the Grand Canyon, a federal park, Fife Symington sent state people up to open the park, which caused a great controversy between the federal government and the state government, and to a number of people became the real reason why the federal government went after him and claimed that he had given false reports on his financial statement. He had never taken any money from anyone. What he was run out of office for was supposedly giving false financial information by exaggerating the net worth of some of the properties that he owned. And that was it.
Interesting, because that's a gray area anyway.
Yes.
I mean,
but he was run out of office for that. And as far as you ask anyone
mm-hmm.
what Fife Symington did was, well, he stole money and went to jail.
Hmm.
And that's not what happened.
Case.
So there's a lot more to that story. And I don't want to try to prejudge what he did or why he did it. All I know is that what he did made my stand even more difficult.
Well, it is great, and if it's true and everything, what he's claiming now, which he saw the Phoenix Lights, and it was a huge Chevron-shaped craft, and he believes that it is not something that is of this world
yes.
and the technology beyond us. It's a brave of him to do so, to come forward now, if that is the case. So hopefully he's...
Yes.
The
Bravo.
Genuine thing where he's making amends for those
mm-hmm.
for that period of time. Although, really in government, and I think people listening to the show probably understand that the people who seem to be the guys really controlling things have a lot of, it's a lot more difficult than just, hey, I'm the boss, this is what we're going to do, I'm the governor, I'm the president.
Yes.
There's a lot of people they have to please have a strong say in what they're doing.
Yes.
So now that we've got 10 minutes left, before we leave the Phoenix Lights, I did also want to mention that Dr. X, who you referred to, Lynn Cotai, we know her as now, has now created probably the best documentary on the Phoenix Lights with hundreds of lots of witnesses on this documentary. And so she's out there speaking about everything she experienced during that period of time.
Yes.
So, and you've been part of that a bit.
I'm in that, yes.
Yep. So that's kind of interesting that she would hide her who she was back then, but now she's really out and about in this subject.
Well, she further investigated what had gone on that night and the rest of the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
She got religion about it, so
yeah.
to say, and
mm-hmm.
saw that being a messenger of what really happened was more important than protecting her career.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, her husband, Frank, and her kids support her work.
Mm-hmm. Which is great.
That's great.
So what are you up to now?
Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying for many years the effects of outside stimuli on plants,
mm-hmm.
seeds and plants. And I've been developing technologies for making plants grow faster, more nutrition, larger.
Have you heard about how the seeds and crop circles will often, in the genuine anomalous ones, will
yes.
grow quicker?
Yes.
Due to an uh-huh. electromagnetic pulsing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked into that?
I've read about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been after Peter Sorensen for years to send me a bag of seeds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Frank Burke of BLT has done a lot of investigation into that.
Is that bacon, lettuce, and tomato?
BLT? The BLT research group.
Oh, yeah, I don't know them.
Yeah, that's the one Nancy's part of.
Oh, okay, great.
So,
well, forgive me for calling it.
You'll have to look into that.
Bacon, lettuce, and tomato.
Well,
yeah.
That's what everybody calls it.
Yes. Oh, do they?
Yeah.
And we've discovered that scientifically there is a precedent for it
mm-hmm.
in that the Hopi, the Dogon tribe, the Allied tribe in Australia, all and Plains Indians, have been using certain sounds and instruments for thousands of years to stimulate plant growth. In fact, the
really?
Dogon tribe in Ethiopia grows huge fruits and vegetables in terrible soil
mm-hmm.
and has a planting ceremony with some really bizarre sounds and instruments. And we've been analyzing those frequencies and wave shapes and the modulation patterns and sounds of birds and bugs and bees and thunder and all the combination of sounds and ground vibrations that will increase the, for those of you interested, lycopene and proline content, increase the mitochondria rate of adenosine triphosphate. And there will be a test later, so you write down these words.
Interesting. That's what someone in the chat was saying earlier. There's going to be a quiz. So what is that? What are one of the items that you've seen that has the biggest effect?
Well, the sound waves, specifically. And it's
biggest.
A pattern. We can get the seed germination in 2 days
wow.
on things that might take 10 to 15 days. And the guy that wrote the book many years ago in the 70s, Christopher Bird, wrote The Secret Life of Plants,
mm-hmm.
spent a lot of time with me in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
At my ranch, the Flying Heart Ranch in Arizona, looking at my techniques and networking for me to introduce me to others that might use it. So it's I created some gadgets and some sounds many years ago that have been marketed as Sonic Bloom
mm-hmm.
by Dan Carlson, Sonic Bloom Company, and I have a new generation of sounds that I've been experimenting with on large scale, 1,000 acres at a time in Indonesia and in Nebraska. We find sometimes a 20-fold, 2,000% increase in things
wow.
like lettuce and radishes and mm-hmm. cantaloupes. We've experimented with golden seal, echinacea, and with corn and potatoes and flowers and
so there might be
plants.
Something to the mythology that talking to your plants actually...
There is. In fact, the Mythbusters did a show number 14.
Really?
Yeah. They built 6 greenhouses and had silence, man talking, acoustic music, symphony music, blah, 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 and it grew bigger. They couldn't bust the myth. In fact, there's 10 pages devoted to us in their, well, to it, to the
yeah.
process, in their new book called Don't Try This at Home. And there's been stories about us on CNN and growing grapes in Italy. And it's a process of deciding what's going to be public domain that we're going to give away and patenting the devices and working with organic food growers. And we've been talking seriously with the Red Cross about emergency food growing kits. And we've been going to FEMA, some disaster preparedness training seminars about creating fast grow food packages for Katrina type situations and backyard
oh,
growing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. If people wanted to read more about that, where would they find information?
They have to email me about it because it's a very precise process. We don't have a website about it.
Okay.
But my email is the last four letters of my name, Jim Delatoso, T-O-S-O, at cox.net, C-O-X.net. And I have lots of white papers, and I have lots of diagrams and how-to things. Because we're waiting for the patents, which we applied for a few years ago, there are certain rules about, you know, run silent, run deep while you're waiting for the patents.
Gotcha.
But in the meantime, I'm not really patent-driven. I bounce it off of a satellite and give it to the poor people of the world. That's my decision.
I guess my last question is a UFO question.
Yes.
Since you've been involved with this for so long and so much in the media, have you seen a change in the way media treats the subject?
Yes. Media is more open-minded. Mm-hmm. UFO community is more mean-spirited.
Interesting.
Yes.
There's kind of been a flop somehow that way.
Right. So, yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, a lot of investigators, a lot of chat rooms, a lot of people are really mean-spirited. They're not open-minded. They're closed-minded and wanting to crush the entire position that extraterrestrials might be coming here. And then when open-minded media use the net or other media outlets to find experts, those experts now give them negative information.
Mm-hmm.
When they're open-minded to report whatever is told to them. But I find the general public and the media is more intelligent, and a large faction of the UFO research community has become mean-spirited.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting perspective, and I guess, you know, looking at it, certainly I can see why he didn't have that perspective.
But open minds will save the day.
Exactly. You know, yes. We're the great hope for this field.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
It was a lot of fun, a lot of great information, and I think a lot of people need to be introduced to some of these old cases, especially like the Billy Meyer case and some of the evidence, because like you said, there's a lot of mean-spirited people out there who do a lot of talking, but they don't really present the evidence, which is the most important aspect as to figuring out whether or not something's real.
Yes.
So next week is Christmas Eve. So we're not going to have a show next week. We're going to have to wait a couple weeks. Everybody have a great Christmas out there. And then a couple weeks we'll have another excellent guest. Hopefully it'll be someone close enough where I can get into the studio. But not all UFO researchers live in Phoenix. And unfortunately, we don't have the budget to fly people in on every show yet.
Before we sign off, can I just say one thing about the secret of Santa Claus? One thing I have discovered. Santa Claus... Mm-hmm. is really one of the three wise men still alive today. You check out that manger scene, okay? You get that manger scene. Look at the guy with the purple hat on, with the funny hat. That's Santa Claus.
Now, have you verified a photo of the manger scene to be real?
No, I have not. It's just a feeling that I have that if Santa Claus really exists, he's got some special power.
Yeah, he's got to be magic.
Staying alive this long, and it's that guy standing there in the manger scene, and he still brings presents to people that are good.
Well, now I'm going to have to say something mean. I'm skeptical about this whole Santa thing.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm just kidding.
I'm open-minded. We can be mean about Santa Claus,
too. Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Go on a diet.
Yeah, huh? All right. Well, Santa Claus, if you're out there, I was just kidding. And, you know, I don't know what a UFO is what I want for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of cool sports model beam ship like the Billy Meyer Pleiadians drive. All right. Thanks, everybody. We will talk to you in a couple weeks.